You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, September 26, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Laura Gotsen-Diner, A Dream Foreclosed, Black America, and A Fight for a Place Called Home. Also on the program today, we are a day away from the IPCC report on global warming. It only gets worse from here, folks. It only gets worse from here. Meanwhile, talk of an $11 billion settlement for J.P. Morgan's nefarious mortgage securities practices. We're also a couple of days away from the full-fledged launch of Obamacare. We know what the premiums are going to be. They're going to be higher for those people who are young and healthy in some instances, at least on the exchanges, and lower for a lot more. Also, we are now 3 weeks away from the debt limit ceiling being surpassed, according to the Obama administration. It's moved up. What's going to happen? You will not believe what the Republicans want in exchange for raising the debt ceiling limit. And we also have a wonderful exchange which shows just how stupid Ari Fleischer is. And Marissa Alexander, the woman in Florida sentenced to 20 years for discharging a firearm in Florida, despite pleading stand your ground against her husband, will get a new trial. All that and more on today's program. Let's just do this Ari Fleischer thing right up top, because it's just too fun not to. Just to show you just how absurd these people are. And I should also say that Eric Erickson had a wonderful tweet the other day. Just shows just the racist foundations of the Republican Party. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. So the other day, Ari Fleischer, the esteemed former, I guess, spokesperson for the Bush administration, responded to a tweet by President Obama, which was, quote, not only are premiums lower than they were, they're lower than most optimistic predictions. It was President Obama on Obamacare the other day at a speech. And Ari Fleischer, ever on the ball, willing to really tackle the issues head on, says, question to @gov. How come at Barack Obama's last tweet was more than 140 characters? Does he play by different rules? Question mark, question mark, question mark. He tweeted that at 6:28 p.m. And then at 6:38 p.m. at Gov, and this one, of course, was basically a subtweet in the sense that before he wanted everyone to see this, and now he at Govs. If you put an at the beginning of the tweet, it only goes to the account that you're tweeting. At Gov, I retract my tweet. When I copy and pasted it, it included the at Barack Obama. Ari Fleischer on the case. Well, I don't want to do 140 tweets. Just get me whatever I want. That's what I did with Obamacare.
Look, I have Al Shabaab on the other line. I don't really have that much time for this.
That's right.
I'm going to need the Twitter people to correct my Twitter limit.
I'm planning a tax in Nairobi. Or I'm supposed to count out how many characters in my tweet. I can't do it.
Wait, I need to orchestrate a mall attack? Figure out my social media plan at the same time? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, can't do it. Get me one of those Hootsuite or whatever it is. I'm not going to call it Hootsuite. I'm going to call it something longer. Hootsuite, Hootsuite. How do you like that? Thank you, Ari Fleischer. Almost as nice as hearing my daughter sing Singing in the Rain. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this with Laura Gotzendiner. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, Laura Gotzendiner, the author of A Dream Foreclosed, Black America, and A Fight for a Place Called Home. Welcome to the program, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start. I mean, one of the figures that your book brings out is that we have 10 million Americans in about 4.5 million homes that have been foreclosed upon over the past, I guess, 6 or 7 years. It's a pretty stunning number.
It's really quite staggering. I mean, it's as if every single man, woman, and child in the state of Michigan were forced from their homes in the last, as you said, 5 or 6 years. So those numbers are since 2007. And the thing that's really most striking to me is that those numbers go up every single day. I mean, over the summer, even as we're talking about being in the midst of this unprecedented housing recovery, we're still seeing 30,000 or 40,000 completed foreclosures every single month.
And let me ask you this. Why did your book focuses on the plight in particular of Black Americans who have gone through foreclosure? Tell us why you decided to deal with this issue from that angle.
Sure, and I want to be clear. It deals with the plight, but it also deals with the organizing and the resistance that this community has been executing over the last number of years. And so, you know, just statistically speaking, African Americans and all people of color were significantly more likely to be targeted for the predatory loans that then exploded and, as a result, are significantly more likely to be foreclosed on. So you see African Americans being twice as likely to be foreclosed on than a white American. And most sort of shockingly, and a number that really disputes the Republican idea that it was because, you know, African Americans didn't have as good credit and this and that. You saw African American families with high credit scores, good credit scores, being three times more likely to be targeted and sold a predatory loan than a white American family. So you can see how institutional racism really is alive and well in the mortgage practice. But I actually didn't choose to focus on this community because they've been the hardest hit by the crisis. I chose to focus on them because I started this book by documenting the organizing and the resistance to foreclosure and eviction that was happening all over the country. And from city to city, every place I went, I was stunned by how successful and how inspiring the organizing in many African American communities is. And I thought that was a story that people of all races really needed to know, because we all need to learn from this organizing.
Yeah, I want to talk about the organizing in a bit, but let's go back to how the predatory lending practices of the banks, in particular, how they focused on the black communities, African American communities, communities of color, and how that was in many respects simply part of a narrative that has been going on in this country for over a century.
That's a great question. You know, as I traced in my book, it has been a constant struggle, one that has been, you know, led by resistance and organizing since the Reconstruction era, for African Americans to have, enjoy the right to have a safe and decent place to live in this country. And it's been quite clear how housing rights and democratic rights, the ability to vote, the ability to have your democratic participation be meaningful, are very linked. As a contemporary example, for example, you know, Detroit, which suffered a terrible loss during the foreclosure crisis, 100,000 families were foreclosed on and evicted from the city. Now they've lost their local democratic right, and you can see that that's obviously not boding well for the bankruptcy that they're going through. So housing rights and democratic rights have been inextricably linked ever since this country was founded on the idea that only white male property owners had the right to vote back at the founding. So what is important to really understand now for this contemporary chapter is the way that the pushing and targeting of predatory loans, what the industry called subprime loans, throughout the 90s and early 2000s, which ultimately led to a lot of the crisis, is related to an earlier period called redlining. And redlining was a institutional practice, a governmental practice, in which the government said, the arm that deals with housing, the Federal Housing Administration, said, we will neither lend nor guarantee lending to families in all of the neighborhoods that we've drawn red lines around in maps of the United States. And if you look at these maps, as many scholars have done, you see that all of the red line neighborhoods are places where people of color lived, non-white people. So it was effectively the government's, you know, stated federal policy that it would not lend nor guarantee lending to any non-white families. As a result of this, and that didn't end until 1968 with the Fair Housing Act, 1977 with the Fair Lending Act, but as a result of that, you know, institutional racism, you saw that communities of color were quite starved for mortgages. And so when the market opened up, as it had to, as a result of the federal legislation, we saw Wall Street banks saying, ah, we can take advantage of this country's history of racism to make an incredible profit very quickly. And even if that's also racist practices, well, they did it. And as a result, we're seeing an incredibly, you know, racially tilted foreclosure crisis today.
Now, we should say that the implications of the redlining, meaning that African Americans or these communities could not get houses, also has a tremendous economic effect through generations. If you don't have, I mean, people's houses end up being one of their biggest asset, particularly at the end of life, and it's something that is passed on either in the form of a house or in the cash that you get from selling off that house at the end of your life to generations. So this was a fundamental sort of building block of keeping these communities from building any wealth.
Well, you're completely correct, and thank you for adding that to this discussion. The inability for the African American community to build intergenerational wealth is still so alive today, and it's you know, completely as a result of this institutional discrimination perpetrated by the government. And so I was recently down in D.C. for a panel hosted by the Black Congressional Caucus, and the panel was asking, you know, very honestly, is the so-called housing recovery real for African Americans? And every single panelist agreed, no, it's not real. And one of the major statistics that people were looking at was the wealth gap in between African American families and white families. And the wealth gap is staggering. We're talking about white families having, on average, 20 times the amount of wealth of black families. And that's very tied. It's the primary reason for that is because of the inability, you know, to own homes, to build home ownerships as a result of redlining.
And so the Fair Housing Act passes in 68. Additional legislation in 77, including the Community Reinvestment Act in 77.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until, I mean, we didn't really see this aggressively start to happen to the 90s or maybe even to the aughts. I mean, what, give us a timeline of what happened there. And it wasn't, I mean, my understanding is it was not necessarily a function of the Community Reinvestment Act, because when we look at foreclosures, we see that only about 20% of banks that were subject to the CRA were providing these subprime loans. Most of those foreclosures came, the vast majority, came from banks that were not subject to the Community Reinvestment Act. So this is basically just, but why did the banks say that we need to enter into this market, we need to do it aggressively? What was happening with the rest of the mortgage market that forced them to do that? Or that, I guess, compelled them is really the better word.
Sure. You know, there's a lot of things in that. I mean, I think it's important to state, because there's been such a warped narrative coming from some of the sort of fringe right wing of this country, the Community Reinvestment Act had nothing to do with the subsequent subprime crisis. You know, again, back when I was down in D.C., one expert presented unbelievably irrefutable evidence that the share of loans that went to African American families and was sort of propelled by the Community Reinvestment Act was so small, there's no way it could have created this crisis. So I think it's really important to explain that from the offset, because there's been a lot of propaganda and lies around that issue. What was happening, you know, to move to your broader question, what was happening in the late 80s and 90s was you were seeing such a bifurcation of the mortgage market racially that it became really important. Well, you know, industry decided it was really important. Finally, they wanted to move into the so-called minority market as a primary market. And what was happening was the gap in home ownership between white Americans and non-white Americans was so great. You know, you saw white Americans more than 70% owning their own home. You saw less than half of African Americans and other people of color owning their own home. So if you were a white American and you'd been a beneficiary of all of this federal lending, all of these subsidies that only went to white Americans, you owned your home if you wanted to, or if you were in any sort of economic position to do so. In the African American community, that was not the case. So banks started to see this is a new untapped market. And what also led to, you know, the pushing of bad mortgages there were two things. So you had Wall Street and the major banks moving into sort of more of the fringe and predatory practices. You had, you know, acts of Congress that deregulated the banking industry. You had the ability for them to issue these ballooning mortgages called adjustable rate mortgages, or ARMs, which meant, you know, the interest rate was not fixed, but it was tied to financial markets. And more than anything, you had the rise of the securitization process. And the securitization process essentially meant that every single person along the chain, so if Countrywide issues a mortgage and then sells it to J.P. Morgan and then J.P. Morgan bundles it and sells it to investors, every single person along that chain can cash out whether or not the mortgage is ever paid back. And the only people that can't are the homeowners, obviously, who suffered repossessions and evictions, and some of the investors. And so that's why we're seeing a lot of investor lawsuits against J.P. Morgan or Bank of America or all right now. But the major losers of the securitization process were undoubtedly homeowners. We were the only ones that were not insured, that were not securitized. So we put up collateral, you know, in the form of the homes, but nobody else was taking any risk. And the ability to eliminate risk on the part of the finance industry, well, that allowed them to really just go bananas.
And the reality is, when you're talking about communities that have not had the opportunity to get mortgages over the course of generations, you're talking about and it's well documented just how confusing just mortgages are, period. In fact, in many respects, Elizabeth Warren, who is, was the champion of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, she started talking about this issue maybe 8 or 10 years ago, writing as a contracts professor at Harvard, just how impossible it was to actually understand these documents. To what extent did the banks realize that not only is there an untapped market here in terms of these minority communities that have been before 77 fully redlined, but there's also a tremendous amount of financial illiteracy that we can take advantage of?
I think that's, important. But I also think that it's important to state that, because financial literacy, the way that we talk about it, it's always on the burden of us, ordinary people, to educate ourselves. And yes, there was a lot of financial literacy. The important thing to note is these loans were written to be unintelligible. So it wasn't simply the idea that, people in inner city neighborhoods couldn't understand these loans. Nobody could understand these loans. These loans were written to be unintelligible. I mean, we had the Attorney General of California, Kamala Harris. I don't understand my loan. So that's important to state. It's not our burden. These were unintelligible loans.
And so, and they were incentivized, really. I mean, you had mortgage originators fully incentivized to put people into the riskiest and biggest and riskiest because they were the biggest loans, which would offer, obviously, more fodder for the securitization process.
Yeah, exactly. So there were cash incentives for loan officers to push people, even if they had credit that would have qualified them for a prime loan, good loan. They received more money, the loan officers, if they pushed these consumers into subprime loans. And it's really well documented how there was sort of a two-tier information system at play, where loan officers were privy to a lot of information that the families seeking a loan were not privy to, and how the loan officer's compensation was directly tied to essentially how bad of a loan they could trick people into signing. And so it's quite obvious that we could structure a system in which the incentives were to get people into safe loans. But right now we have a system in which the incentive is to get people into loans that are more likely to default and be foreclosed on.
One of the loans that I know you talk about is the interest-only negative amortizing adjustable rate loans. I mean, that is just basically a ticking time bomb.
Yeah, I mean, the New York Times has called these a ticking time bomb. Multiple, financial experts have called these ticking time bombs. The way they work is you don't explain how these loans work to people, but how they work is you pay for years, sometimes for decades, and what you're only paying is a fraction of the interest rate. So what you're doing is you're paying each month, and you assume that your principal, the amount you owe on your loan, is going to go down. But what's happening is the principal on your loan is only going up. So, for example, in the book, one of the four main people that I followed was a woman named Bertha Garrett. She took out a $40,000 loan, and it ballooned to $190,000. She was paying that whole time. She believed she was paying down her loan, yet her loan principal was ballooning. It was out of control.
You focus the book on four people: Bertha Garrett in Detroit, Martha Biggs in Chicago, Michael Hutchins in Tennessee, and Griggs Wimbley in North Carolina, I believe. Tell us a little bit about Bertha Garrett and talk about what she ultimately did to fight her foreclosure.
Sure. So Bertha Garrett, when I met her, she was 65 years old, a grandmother up in northwest Detroit, and quite religious. And so she and her family had moved from Alabama, settled in Detroit as part of the Great Migration. And she lived in her home for 22 years. She paid off her first loan in full. And then she, like so many other mostly older women, were targeted for these secondary loans. And what happened a lot, and it's well documented, but people don't really write about it or examine it very closely, is you'd have loan officers calling up mostly, you know, middle-aged elderly women, oftentimes multiple times a day, every day of the week. And they'd be saying, you know, you're sitting on equity, you're sitting essentially on a bank, don't you have kids in college or don't you have grandkids in college? And is it really fair for you to be allowing your kids or your grandkids to be taking out these educational loans when you're sitting on a whole pile of cash? And why don't you just, you know, take out a small loan on your house? You can pay it back. Don't worry. You can refinance. You know, housing prices are always going up. And that way, you know, your son or your grandson or your granddaughter won't be in debt. And it was an incredibly compelling pitch. And hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people across the country, you know, agreed. And so that's what happened to Bertha. She took out a $40,000 loan. It was an incredibly predatory loan. It ballooned to $190,000 in principal, as I explained to you. And meanwhile, Detroit was collapsing around her. So, you know, the subprime mortgage crisis hit Detroit in 2004. And suddenly she just sees, you know, half of her block be evicted. She just sees property values plummet. So as her monthly payments are going up, she's paying $2,500 a month. She sees the house across the street from her sell outright for $3,500. So she's living in this Kafkaesque situation, which is essentially the state of Detroit and some other cities that have been wrecked by this crisis. And meanwhile, she's suffering, you know, personal family traumas. Her husband suffers a series of strokes. Her daughter loses her job. And it gets to the point they can't continue to pay this absurd principal. They can't continue to pay $2,500 a month on a house that's probably worth around $10,000. So she defaults, and, you know, she receives an eviction notice. But what struck me about her story is she decided, no, I actually feel like I own this home. I actually understand that there's a higher law of ownership and that I have a responsibility to my somewhat floundering community to stay. And I understand that it would be in the best interest not only of my family, but of this entire community, of this entire city, if I stay and fight for the vitality of this city. So she called up her neighbors, she called up her church group, she called up the newspaper, she called up these activist groups, Moratorium Now, People Before Banks, Occupy Homes Detroit. And she said, I don't want to leave my home. Will you support me? Will you stay with me? And hundreds of people amassed on her front lawn the day of her scheduled eviction. And they actually blocked the city's dumpster, which had come to, you know, be parked in front of her house, in which, you know, bank contractors could haul out all of her things. And inspired by that, then she went down to her bank to try to simply renegotiate her mortgage. But when they wouldn't let her in to even have a meeting with them, she said, you know, in the spirit of nonviolent civil disobedience, I am not leaving. I am not going to move if you won't even have a decent meeting with me to renegotiate this mortgage. So she lies down in front of the office of this bank, Bank of New York Mellon, based in New York, but the office in Detroit, and won't move. She doesn't leave for hours. And so this becomes, you know, a minor media sensation in Detroit. And so, you know, the next day, after hundreds more people amass on her front lawn the next morning, and there's, you know, a number of news articles about it and many people calling the bank saying, what's going on? The bank's lawyers simply call her lawyers and say, we don't want this negative press. If she wants this home, she can take this home. And a few months later, they sat down with her and sold her the home outright for $10,000. And it's a very clear example to me of how if we stand up, and if we stand up in the hundreds or in the thousands, the banks will renegotiate this stuff and they will capitulate because they know they're in the wrong, both morally, financially, and in the best interest of this country.
And so, I mean, how is this? How is this scalable? I mean, you have a 65-year-old woman who is lying mm-hmm. down in front of a bank is going to get the press there. It's going to get that negative publicity. I mean, how is it? I mean, how? What
it's
is
great
the
question?
What is
how
the
do
mechanism?
You scale that up?
Yeah, I mean, this is I mean, because I know you. I mean, you present stories of individuals who basically buck the trend, but in some respects, because it is individuals, and the banks will still collect their fees for foreclosing. We spoke earlier this week to David Dayan, who's done a lot of reporting on this, that the mortgage originators, they get better fees if they foreclose as opposed mm-hmm. to modifying, even with bonuses theoretically from the government through programs like HAMP. I mean, how is it if does the strategy change? Does the calculation change for the bank if it's not one 65-year-old woman, but it's people from all ages across the board challenging them? How do you scale that up?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's the most important question. That's the question I get all the time, because a few good stories is inspiring, but we need to scale this to actually make this a movement. It's important, I think, to note when this has scaled in U.S. history in the past, because it has scaled up to, you know, quite staggering levels, and as a result, we've seen federal action. And I think that it's important to understand that the banks probably will not, out of their own good nature or heart, change their action. We need to scale this to the point that it becomes untenable for the government not to take action. So, for example, during the Great Depression, when you had hundreds of eviction blockades every single day. I mean, there was a point where landlords, and Mark Nason has done very good writing about this, but there was a point when landlords were saying, we can't evict anybody in the Bronx because the people own the streets. We can't evict anybody in Harlem. We can't evict anybody in the Lower East Side because so many hundreds of people, thousands of people every single day were stopping these evictions. So, you know, fast forward a few years, and you saw that 26 states across the country enacted foreclosure moratoriums, saying, actually, we are not going to allow these foreclosures to happen. You had, you know, one governor, as he was running for his governorship, which he ultimately won, saying, if a banker comes to your home, you should shoot the banker if he comes to your farm to try to repossess on your farm. So you saw an incredibly different approach by the government at all levels to this crisis, and that was as a result of the organizing that was happening on the ground. The other very good example of federal action as a result of decades of organizing is what happened, you know, in 68 and 77 with the Fair Housing Act. And that would never 2 decades of on-the-ground organizing in Chicago and other major cities, forcing the government to take action on that front. And the housing fight, you know, really in some ways kicked off a lot of the civil rights stuff, because that was happening in the 50s and the 60s, you know, early. And so we need to, and the question of whether or not this moment has passed, I think, is a good one, but we would need this moment to scale up considerably. And what should have happened is that the government should have declared, you know, national foreclosure moratorium as early as 2009 or 2010. And the interesting thing is the majority of Americans polled in 2010 wanted a foreclosure moratorium. They thought the fact that we were experiencing 1 million evictions in 2010, they thought that was absurd.
So, I mean, let's talk about that moment, whether that moment has passed and what kind of sort of organizations are on the ground. I mean, you write about city life up in Boston. You know, I know that you spent a considerable time down at Zuccotti Park. Your book is was published by Zuccotti Park Press. I mean, what if not then? How bad does it have to get? Yeah, can you hear me? I'm sorry. Hello. Oh, I think we lost her. We'll call her right back.
I just got you back.
Oh, okay. All right. So my question
Sorry
for
about
you,
that.
That's okay. I'm not sure if you heard it, but I mean, let's talk about whether or not that time has passed. I mean, I mentioned that I know that you've covered sort of the broader organizing that's taking place. You talk about city life in Boston. But I mean, why has that moment passed? Why didn't it catch on? And what's it going to take if not when we're having, literally millions of people being thrown out of their homes? We're going to call her back, folks. Sorry, apologize for that. Hi, sorry about that, Laura. So, let me.
No problem.
I don't know what.
I think I understand your question.
Okay. Yeah. What's the best answer we have now?
I mean, I think that it's. So it's important to know there are still hundreds, if not thousands, of anti-foreclosure and anti-displacement groups on the ground right now doing really good work. You mentioned City Life, Vita Urbana in Boston, obviously Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign in Chicago has gotten incredible amount of press for the work they're doing to liberate bank-owned homes on the south side and on the west side. What's important to think about is how the strategy shifts to reflect the moment that we're in right now, because there's still an incredible amount of potential. And the moment that we're in right now is a little bit different. There are still, as I mentioned, tens of thousands of foreclosures every month, but it is down from the numbers we were seeing in 2009 and 2010. But what's going on right now, and it's incredibly insidious, and some groups are starting to organize against it, is that massive private equity companies and hedge funds, groups like Blackstone Group, are buying up in bulk tens of thousands of these foreclosed properties around the country. And it's been really something of a real estate buying frenzy over the last year. And there's been a little bit of financial press about it, but nobody's really been understanding or examining the on-the-ground implications. But what the underground implications are is that what we're seeing is a massive future wealth transfer. If the foreclosure crisis, you know, that started around in 2007, 2008, was a wealth transfer from middle-class Americans right up into the Wall Street banks, what we're now experiencing is a future wealth transfer in the sense that these houses are going to appreciate in value because they plummeted so considerably as a result of the crisis. And yet they're not going to be owned by people in communities. Instead, they're going to be owned in the bulk, in the tens of thousands, possibly in the hundreds of thousands by the time this buying frenzy is over. They're going to be owned by institutional investors. And these institutional investors have made it quite clear that they're out to rent these houses. And so what we're seeing is the conversion of a whole class of people, predominantly in urban centers, in communities of color, being converted from homeowners to renters. And it's not that there's anything bad about renting, but what you explained in the beginning of this segment quite succinctly is that renting doesn't allow people to build, you know, intergenerational wealth. So what I think is important to say is that people and groups on the ground are pursuing two fronts to really combat this problem. One of them is to push for and create openings for alternative ownership models, things like community land trust. And we're seeing a community land trust movement exploding across the U.S. More than 100 community land trusts have been formed in the last 10 years. And this provides a stable model of ownership in which the land is collectively owned, but the homes on top are owned by families just like any other family would own a home. And it's an incredibly community-oriented, stable way to organize land and home ownership in this country. For example, just one statistic. On community land trusts, we saw a tenth of the foreclosure rate than we saw, you know, in the regular private market, meaning that if you lived on a community during the crisis, you were 10 times more likely to keep your home rather than if you lived somewhere else.
Tell us what those are. Yeah, specifically.
Sure. So community land trusts, it's a legal ownership structure in which usually there'll be some municipal financing up front. Sometimes there's not. But what it means is a group of people will purchase tracts of land, an amount of land, and manage it and own it. And usually the group that owns it makes collective decisions, and it's not simply comprised of people who live on that land, but also people who live you know, around it, so neighbors or, you know, surrounding residents, and then usually local public officials. So you see this sort of these three interest groups, local officials, people who then live in this community land trust on this land, and local residents outside of the community land trust, all making decisions about, you know, this land ownership, what's best for it. What then happens is either there are already existing houses on this land or new affordable housing is constructed, and, you know, people will either buy houses outright or usually go and secure loans, but often the community land trust will even do the financing. So they do much safer financing than, for example, a Countrywide ever did or SunTrust Bank. And then people who move into the housing own their land, just like, I mean, oh, sorry, their house, just like any other ordinary homeowner, but they don't own the land underneath. And there's rules and regulations about what they could do on the land. So they couldn't, for example, tear down their house and build up a skyscraper. So it's a way of dealing with a lot of different housing issues all at the same time. It deals with the issue of foreclosure, for example, by, you know, ensuring that good financing, safe financing is on that community land trust. It deals with the issue of gentrification, for example. They were originally started to be formed to stop gentrification because it makes the decisions about what could happen, what kind of redevelopment could happen. People who actually live there in the community get to make those decisions. So a lot of times there's, you know, anti-gentrification measures. So, for example, you can't tear something down and build up a luxury condo unit. So these are something that began, one of the largest and one of the first ones with municipal financing began up in Vermont, and I'm heading up there soon for a story. They began in, you know, the late 70s, but we've seen recently an explosion of them in the last decade. As I mentioned, 100 new ones have formed in just the last decade. You're seeing them form in Ithaca, New York. You're seeing them form in Atlanta, all across the country. And what I'm interested in taking a look at is this really a model that could solve a lot of issues or present a solution for a lot of issues, not just housing, but also issues like environmental use? You know, if land were in community land trusts, would we see, for example, such an explosion of the natural gas industry, such an explosion of fracking across the country? Or would people on community land trusts have made different decisions about whether or not to sign off over their land? Would we have seen something different happen in Appalachia with mountaintop? Would we see something different in Utah with the desire, you know, with the stated goal of opening the first commercial tar sands mine in the United States out there? So I'm really interested in taking a look at this model. As it's a quasi-public, quasi-private model of home ownership that I think could really provide a third way for many communities.
And what's going to become of these vast number of residences that have been bought up by these investment groups? Because, I mean, it seems to me, when they buy a house for $3,500 or $10,000, mm-hmm. and they can start to securitize the idea of long-term rentals at whatever, you know, some fairly low figure to get a very high rate of return, there's no incentive for them to maintain the quality of this housing. There's no incentive for them to maintain the quality of life within the context of that community. I mean, it seems to me that this is a recipe for huge tracts of basically of slums run by slumlords who are not just, you know, sort of like not living in that community. They are one, two, three steps away from even having any direct sense of ownership of these things.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And absentee landlordism is a huge problem, again, particularly in communities of color and in urban centers. And that's why it's really quite troubling the amount of properties that institutional investors have been purchasing over the last year. I was just yesterday talking to a real estate broker out in LA, and he was saying he works, you know, in, you know, inner city LA in Inglewood, and he was saying, I'm a real estate broker. I've been selling, you know, hundreds of houses over the last 2 years. And over the last 2 years, I have not sold a single home to an African-American family, even though it's an African-American community, because the descent of these institutional investors who were able to outbid any family and pay in cash, he's saying, I am trying to find these families' homes and get them to be able to buy them. I can't get any of these families to buy these homes because these institutional investors, these Blackstones of the world, have just swooped in and bought up thousands over the last year. And, you know, there's no sort of financing. They have all the cash. You can't compete with cash. So, you know, and for another article, it varies depending on where. So, for example, in L.A., you know, this real estate broker was saying all of the Blackstone houses, and they're using a group called Invitation Homes, so they don't use their private equity firm name, are rented because it's such a hot rental market. So there, everything's rented. But, you know, if you look at Detroit, Baltimore, or some of these other places where institutional investors are also snapping up a lot of rental properties, they're not being rented. And there you can see that, you know, it makes more sense simply for a private equity company to just hold on to it. It's just an asset on their books and maybe land bank the house for 10 years, maybe 20 years, till however long they think it will take until the prices rise. So, absentee landlordism and land banking is a huge problem. And right now we're seeing essentially zero regulation of this new rush by institutional investors into the rental market. I mean, this is the first time we've ever seen institutional investors at this scale entering the rental market. And they've already figured out, you know, and they've made quite public, a way in which they're going to securitize these rental payments. So we're seeing the same securitization process that was applied to mortgages now being applied to rental properties. And nobody knows how this is going to go.
And I mean, this is absentee. We almost don't even have a word for this, because absentee landlordism, at least sort of, there is some direct line you can derive from that property to that landlord. In this case, you've got these properties. Essentially, the landlords are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of different institutional investors who have hundreds of thousands of people investing in those, in these securities. I mean, there's no one person here. There's no,
exactly.
It really is. This is going to be, in 5 years when we reconvene, this is going to be one of the disasters that we are talking about. I'm convinced of it. It is really problematic.
I agree with you. I think the thing that we have to note is, yes, houses and home ownership build wealth in communities, stabilize communities, and do all of these things. However, we have to remember, at least in my mind, from my perspective, having traveled around and seen a lot of the neighborhoods hit by foreclosure, we have to remember that first and foremost, houses are the places where people live. And if we don't at least value them for their use value as the homes, the places where kids grow up, families are raised, where people get married and live, where most of the important memories in life happen, where people sleep. If we don't at least remember that housing has to serve that function in this country and has to serve it really well because it's the bedrock of people living in the United States, we're going to have a massive. And so I completely agree with you. The idea that hundreds of investors all around the world would so-called own, you know, the apartment in which I live, and I don't even know where my rental payments are going, and I don't even know who's on the hook if there's a problem. It doesn't bode well for the idea that we, more than anything, simply want safe and stable places to live in this country. So we really need to remember that houses have to be valued for their use value.
It's a good place to end. Laura Gottesdiener, the book is A Dream Foreclosed, Black America and a Fight for a Place Called Home. We've got a link up to it on majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for your questions.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. I will take your calls, and when we get into, we will also take your IMs. We're starting to see it calm down a little bit on the app. Still, you know, on day one, the IMs on the app, we had literally, I think, 150 IMs, and it is as it anticipated. It's calmed down. I remember when cell phones started to become ubiquitous, and I would just get random calls from my father, like, "Hey, guess where I'm calling you from? I'm outside. I'm calling you. I'm outside. That's great, Dad. Okay. Gotta go.
Why do you still call Matt and I like that?
Huh?
I said, why do you still
call Matt? I'm still amazed by the technology. I'm just blown away. Guess where I'm calling you from? I'm in my car. I'm in my car. I'm calling you. But I'm happy to have that excitement about the app. The app is available. If you haven't downloaded yet, you're one of the few people in the entire country who has not. Simply go to majorityapp.com. You'll get a link there to either the iPhone or iPad app or an Android app. Works great on the Galaxy 3S. If you're a Credo subscriber, I think we're going to have another Credo promotion in the coming weeks, if not weeks. So I'm very excited about that. That may end up covering part of the cost of the app. We'll see. You can reach us on IM if you want to be if you want to support this program, if you enjoy it on a daily basis, please become a member today. You can join at majority.fm/become a member. Support this program. Make it easier for us to produce. Make it better because it's easier. Ensure that we're able to continue to do it and expand and grow. You can support this program by buying your Amazon crap through our Amazon link. Go to the front page of majority.fm. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy Amazon crap through that. You can donate to the show, do a one-off if you don't want to have if you don't have the change to become a member on a regular basis. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority. In the better half, we will preview the IPCC governmental report on a global warming. Also mention of $11 billion settlement come from J.P. Morgan. A little bit of Obamacare, a little bit of foreshadowing. Either the potential for a government shutdown or, even worse, a refusal by the Republicans to raise the debt limit ceiling. And we'll talk more about this with Cliff tomorrow on the program, the grand betrayal is rearing its ugly head. Who knows, folks? Also, we'll talk about what a douche Eric Erickson is. This is
a
highfalutin
much,
shoe.
Much lighter
note. It's a highfalutin show.
It's an everything show.
Oh, it's
part of what makes it so good.
All right, folks. See you in the flip side. See you in the flip side.
See you in the flip side.
Indeed.